Welcome to Uproar in the Studio, your weekly Chinese blockbuster podcast. I'm Noah.
I'm Reza.
I'm Andrew, and this is the Jackie Chan post-Rush Hour 3 season.
If you like our show and can afford it, we would really appreciate it if you would contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/uproarinthestudio.
This week we are talking about Kung Fu Yoga, which was released in 2017. Like sometimes, you don't have to see it, but we're going to give a synopsis for this one, and if you want to watch it without spoilers, we'll always be here waiting after you have seen the credits roll.
Later, we'll be talking with Nathan Wang, a composer who's worked on Jackie Chan films going all the way back to Rumble in the Bronx. You can hear his music in The Myth, Chinese Zodiac, the Detective Chinatown movies, Crazy Alien, Jackie Chan's upcoming Vanguard, and of course, Kung Fu Yoga.
After that, we have a conversation with longtime Jackie Chan collaborator, stuntman, and actor Tomer Oz. We ask him about his work on Kung Fu Yoga, Dragon Blade, Chinese Zodiac, Skip Trace, Vanguard, Sky Hunter, and the upcoming Song of the Assassins.
But first, we talk about the movie with Australian film critic Harris Dang. Here's our conversation, starting with the synopsis. In this action comedy, Jackie Chan plays Professor Jack Chan, a world-famous archaeologist who is called upon by an Indian professor to track down the lost Magadha treasure in Tibet. Professor Chan and his team find the treasure, but they are seized by mercenaries sent by an Indian nobleman named Randall, who claims the treasure to be his inheritance. Chan's assistant Jones smuggles the jewels away to an auction in Dubai, and a globe-trotting chase follows as Chan and Randall chase after the lost treasure. The trail eventually leads them to an underground temple of gold. When local monks come upon the excavated temple, both groups realize the treasure must belong to the people. CGI cars, CGI lions, and CGI Jackie Chan. This is Kung Fu Yoga.
How did your rewatch go?
Well, it was my second time watching it, and it was basically exactly the way I remembered it. Let's just leave it at that.
When you first watched it, did you watch it when it like had just come out? Was it in theaters or something?
No, I reviewed it on DVD. It was a screener for the DVD release in Australia.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I didn't know much about it then, but it wasn't high on my expectations list.
So had you been keeping up with the new Jackie Chan releases at that point?
Yeah, I was, and, you know, I haven't liked a lot of his works in the past 10 to 15 years-ish, but it is Jackie Chan, so I might as well be a completionist about it, so, you know.
I mean, I thought he did a pretty good job on this one. I enjoyed his character, at least. It was kind of what he's going for more nowadays.
Yeah, I feel like this one is, like, really leaning into being, instead of an international, I mean, I guess it's definitely an international blockbuster in terms of content, but it feels more like it's leaning into the mermaid vibes, like more Chinese market vibes.
Oh, Chinese market, I definitely would.
I mean, that's why it's interesting that he travels. The story arc for this is kind of like an Indian thing, right? Like, that's why it's weird that it does seem like, you know, we're making this for China, but we don't see this often where it takes place in India. Or, like, other places outside of Australia. There's lots of Australia.
I thought it was funny that early on in this movie, they're like, ah, if you come to India, it'll totally fit in with the Belt and Road. It's great.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that, yeah. They just had to bring it in there, didn't they?
Put it right on the surface, yeah.
I'm shocked to see that because we don't see that, but I feel like that's something that could be in so many movies.
It's also like a movie where Jackie Chan fights for the first time in a while or like has a lot of fight scenes, so I was kind of into that.
I like the ice battle.
No, it's okay. Like, I just expected a bit more invention behind it. The movie basically references The Myth. Like, there's a scene where you see the same painting from The Myth with the Korean actress, and there's a photo of his character with other characters in The Myth. I assume it's the same person. I don't know why it's there if it's not. And it even has the same song from The Myth.
Oh, actually, so yeah. Totally. Yeah. We talked to Nathan Wang on, like, later on in this episode, the composer on both of these movies, and he's like, we started with that song.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I expected some like set piece, like maybe the glue factory, or maybe not as inspired, or something along those lines. Really, it's kind of just the same old, really. Like, the only part that kind of impressed me was the part where he always runs into the icicles in the ice cave yeah. whenever he tries to run away, or whenever he tries to throw a hit. Yeah, that was pretty amusing stuff.
Yeah. I mean, but also...
He gets stuck in a car with a lion.
Yeah. That was very odd. A lion named Jackie.
Of all names, man.
It's interesting that it's globetrotting specifically throughout Asia. Like, they're, like, suddenly cut to Dubai for an auction scene for some reason, then jump
it's
to
weird,
literally
it's weird, but it's
a
very
attraction.
Bollywood kind of way to make a movie. Like... In Bollywood, you know, there'll just be like a plot line and somebody falls in love and then they just end up going to like the Swiss Alps or something. But like for like 7 minutes, they kind of do that kind of thing here. I don't know. There's no real good reason for them to have been in Dubai.
It's like, let's have this random rich character and the daughter come.
Yeah.
Where did yeah, you I mean, come from?
Yeah, that made no sense because for like 15 minutes, she was like a really important character, but that was it. Like, she was just kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess if you're auctioning a diamond, where else would you want to do it? For the shots, for the drone footage.
For the drone footage, for the Avicii, for all of the goofy possible shit you can put in a movie.
They really went in with this one.
Yeah, but it felt like they were having fun on this one. Like, a lot of the time in more recent Jackie Chan movies, it feels like he's slogging through. This one seemed like a good time.
Because they went to Dubai. Do Chinese movies show up in, like, a decent amount of theaters in Australia? I know it's starting to become a thing here.
Oh, yeah, it does. They do. But they show up quite a lot, actually. There's usually just 2, 3, 4 theaters from where I am, but a lot of people show up, and they do show a lot of Chinese movies, yeah.
3, 4 theaters is, like, a lot. In New York, there's just the one AMC that'll do, like, that we saw Wandering Earth in. Or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of cool, though.
Yeah, a lot of people do show up. Most of the time, there's really any Chinese New Year stuff. Like, sometimes there is. I can't even remember if Kung Fu Yoga even showed up in cinemas here, to be honest. I think it just went straight to video. Yeah. I know Bleeding Steel did. I know that much, because I went to see it.
Oh, yeah? How was that in theaters?
Oh, man, it was...
I would hate that in theaters. I would hate to be tied to a chair and have to watch that.
I laughed my ass off throughout the entire film. Like, it was so, like, in my opinion, it was so bad. It was so bad I went to see it again. That's how funny it was. I went to see it again. I was like, I'm enjoying myself. It's so bad, but I'm going anywhere.
I definitely feel that way about some really bad movies, but Bleeding Steel, I just couldn't take. Yeah. That was rough.
That one, I think I've watched like 3 or 4 times at this point, just for like that, prepping for interviews
that, like,
or whatever. And it's
park,
just
that like graffiti skate park scene haunts me. Ugh. Just thinking about having to watch that.
I was like, where is that in Sydney? I need to see that. Like, I really need to see all these parkour free runners.
It was definitely like a couple miles east of Beijing somewhere.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Yeah, that's just a big set.
Oh, man, that's a movie.
Yeah.
Do you remember when, like, Wolf Warrior came out or something?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a big deal down there?
Wolf Warrior 2, yeah. But not,
okay, yeah, yeah.
2. Yeah.
Wolf Warrior, yeah. Like, it's all right.
Yeah, I saw that in the cinema as well. So
I'm so jealous. I hope one day they can show, like, a remastered Wolf Warrior 2.
That part where the guy shoots the rocket launcher and he stops it with the bed frame. Yeah.
Yes!
What the hell was that? I was like, what?
He talked to
the guy. Get out of here.
Honestly, he thought it was awesome. He just loved the fact that you could do that in a movie.
It's amazing, though. It's amazing.
Yeah, I guess there's nothing that's that over the top in Kung Fu Yoga, though. Which
yeah.
Is cool. Like, I thought maybe the scene with the jackals, which had that Lion King dichotomy of lion jackals, was like...
That was good. I enjoyed that.
It was kind of fun, I guess. I don't know. It didn't have Jackie Chan in it.
The action in this was, like, really, really just not ambitious.
That's fair.
Like, in that hyena scene, they kind of just jump around, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's not fun.
Yeah.
To end, because you know it's gonna end, right? There's no suspense.
Yeah, and the wire work is so, like, floaty.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, let's just avoid gravity for the hell of it.
A lot of the fight scenes in this movie are for display. Like, there's that thing where Jack Chan, because, you know, ever since, like, in the last 20 years or whatever, Jackie Chan, more and more often, ever since, I guess, naming his kid JC, wants to play Jackie Chan on screen.
I never noticed.
Yeah. He's Dr. Chan, Jack. No, but, like, he and Jones, when they're on that, like, ice landscape, are doing some sort of display fight for the wolves to, like...
Oh, that was kind
of
weird.
Yeah, that was weird.
Gonna intimidate the wolves by showing off their skills or something like that?
And throwing snowballs at them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Assert your dominance. Like, we were just making snowballs.
Hey, we made some snowmen to scare off the wolves.
The part about that scene that I really enjoyed is that Professor Emeritus Jackie Chan just calls his oil driller friend who shows up in like 2 minutes to drill up an ice hole for them.
And it's Eric Tsang, who has like a tiny part in this movie for some reason.
But it doesn't seem like that scene has any continuity, because his friend obviously was on an oil rig somewhere and just shows up.
Oh, he was in Dubai, 100%. He had to be in the UAE.
Fair enough. Yeah.
We're figuring this out. Slowly we're going to build the connections that make this movie make sense.
Nah, I still think that Prince, the one who's like racing the camel, is the guy who funded this movie, and that's why this movie takes Dubai. And like, so that's totally his lion.
That poor lion. Oh man.
The movie also starts with the Indian villain with a falcon. There's a lot of cool like exotic animals in this.
So okay, can we talk about that Indian villain's like relationship to law?
Do you understand it?
He's like, I am the survival of the fittest. Don't talk to me about the laws of my country. I'm a doctor of law or something.
Yeah, I love how he's like, don't lecture me about bloody Indian law. Don't lecture me about my Indian theory, I'm a Chinese guy.
So this movie is so unsatisfying for this guy, right? Because at the very end, he gets everything he should get, and then, you know, the community just shows up and like, oh shit, you guys found it for us, you know?
Sucks,
he just has no way out. One of his dudes died on the vine.
Oh yeah, that guy. I thought that was a good guy.
They just never circled back to that guy. He totally fell.
Yeah, he did.
I found that to be like a good bit of side comedy. I laughed.
They tried a lot of things in this, but didn't try hard with any of them.
I think it's a movie that doesn't aim so very high, but it does have gags that work. I think the guy getting bit with the snakes all over his face was pretty funny.
Yeah, I enjoyed that whole scene.
Good hanging fruit, you know?
Speaking of hanging fruit, there's a scene where the rope comes out of the pot, and obviously it's not rope, it's a trick.
Yeah.
And you see like...
The guy underneath.
What's his name? Yeah, the guy underneath. You see like Jones trying to fight the guy on it. Yeah.
I always wondered how they did that.
Yeah, this movie is revealing magicians' tricks. That's worth the price of admission alone.
I want to talk about the first 5 minutes. CGI Dynasty Warriors-esque opening scene with the elephants and the war. Like, what is the relation to the whole movie? I mean, apart from the fact that China just had to be connected to the Indian story for some reason.
I feel like that's the best, in terms of, not for story reasons, but in terms of doing the Irishman better than the Irishman, you get to see a 20-year-old Jackie Chan fighting again, essentially. Import him from a drunken master.
I mean, it just looked like a really bad video game.
It really did. He was like that character from Tekken. You know, that cop, what's his name? I think his name's Lay or something. It really looks like a PS2 version of that character from Tekken.
PS2 is
it like
correct
shitty
like
World of Warcraft fan service or something. I don't know. It was bad. And it also didn't do much to explain the plot to me. I mean, you could tell that there's some insurgency in India, and then I don't know what the Chinese had to do with that. I guess they came in and helped the Indians.
Yeah, did they help them like bury this treasure or something? I couldn't tell.
I love the fact that in order to find the artifact to connect it to the treasure, we don't need an Indian person from India to read the Indian inscription of the Indian artifact. We have to go to a Chinese guy to do that.
Yeah, the best in China.
It's a Belt and Road project.
Yeah.
One belt, one road. Let's go.
They didn't even do it subtle. They just like brought it in the open and said it out loud.
Well, so it's like a build-up from Dragon Blade, right? Which is a historical Belt and Road propaganda project to like this being, look at us, we're building a Belt and Road. We are. You know, for all of his archaeology movies, going back to the Armor of Gods back in the 90s, they obviously keep ripping off Indiana Jones. But in this one, again, like, this is a movie where everything comes to the surface. And there's a point where he literally says, I love Indiana Jones.
Yes, yes, that's right. He literally says that. After he puts the diamond on the stick. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the sidekick is literally named Jones.
Yeah. It's all on the surface, but I think I appreciate that about this movie. Again, like we said before, it's not all that ambitious, but it's fun in that, like, they achieve what they're going for, where it moves so quickly that you don't even know what the plot is. You just see some action.
Well, it's nice to know this movie probably is illegal in India now.
Yeah. They outlawed this and TikTok.
I mean, I'm assuming. If I was in charge of the censorship in India, I would get rid of this movie ASAP. Yeah, so, like, just in the last, I don't know, 6 weeks, this movie is historically moot.
Well, in the last, like, 2 months, everything is historically moot. Would it have been better if there were more Bollywood elements, do you think?
I think most things would make this better. I don't know. I mean...
it'd be an hour longer for one thing.
That's true. I would not like that as it's my job to watch these multiple times. I don't know if I'd like that, but end sequence is good.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Again, I think I come down more on the side of this was a fun movie where my brain kind of turned off for a little bit and I was like spoon-fed some propaganda. I'm down.
I enjoy movies that never try, you know? Right. So, like, you can kind of sit down and just, like, go on Twitter or something and, like, you don't miss anything.
It's true. You can just, like, not even watch the movie watch and, like, come back 30 minutes later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you won't miss anything in the plot.
Suddenly they're in Dubai. Okay, there's a camel.
This rules. And then you go back to Twitter.
And they start.
It's a good genre for the streaming era.
Honestly, though, yeah. I don't know how much this movie was made. Like, I can't imagine seeing this in a theater.
I can. I could see it being a movie that's better in theaters to a certain degree. Because, you know, there's, like, chase scenes.
In terms of, like, action being better in theaters,
it's, like, expansive.
Cool.
You know, it's, like, meant for a big screen, I think. This is, like, a mindless blockbuster. Or it tries
to. I remember the car chases in the film. The cars move so fast and so weightless. It's like micro machines or Hot Wheels or something. I'm like, what the hell? Like, especially when the guy driving, what was it, a Lambo or a Ferrari? I'm not really sure.
Well, he just
the yellow car.
Guy.
Yeah, I was like, what the hell? How fast and smooth and weightless is that? It just looks so fake.
Yeah. I mean, it's good for the Dubai cops. They got to do something.
They got to do something rather than, like, chasing down, you know...
Let's just endanger the lives of people in Dubai just to get the treasure.
Yeah, I mean, they have, like, the cops have, like, Ferraris, so it's like they didn't have to spend any money on that.
I'm sure Jackie Chan can get that deal. He can work
that
out.
You don't need to, though, is the point. If you shoot in Dubai, you've got that.
Probably. It's a tax break on top of it.
The best part of that chase scene is when the villain, right, he has his car flip up in the air, right, and somehow he just jumps out of the window during midair and he just walks away as if he's like Daniel Craig in the Skyfall when a train carriage goes away and just, like, you know, fixes his tie or his suit or something and then leaves. I'm like, get the hell out of here, man. That's just super smooth, man.
Yeah, but
just so simple.
Daniel Craig has to, like, adjust his cuffs, whatever. Daniel Craig is a little bit ruffled. This guy's smooth.
Yeah,
he comes from the
smooth
Bollywood tradition where, like, you just have to do these things in stride. You know, like, you're never phased in a Bollywood movie. The actual logistics, the physics don't actually need to work.
Nah, they don't. There's, like, the last movie I saw him in, I think it was called Happy New Year. He's basically just making fun of his own tough guy image. Someone talks about his mother or something, and he just goes aggro. He just, like, beats everyone in the room. I'm like, what the hell? But he's like the complete opposite. It's like, oh, I'm smooth, you know. Nothing really phases me except anyone who lectures me about India. And then I'll get angry. And then the law of nature or whatever.
Why do you think Jackie plays this character who, like, is repeatedly like, no, don't cash in on gold. This is history. Like, he's very adamant about...
Well, this is a development, though, from Chinese Zodiac, right? Because in Chinese Zodiac, he's very much more in the Jones mindset. He, at first, is like...
Yeah, just stealing it back, yeah.
Well, no. At first, he's just stealing it to sell it to Oliver Platt, the other white guy, right? From one white guy to another. But in this movie, he's a proper archaeologist.
I think it's just Chinese censorship, really. I mean...
You think it's changed that much since 2012?
I guess. I mean, 8 years ago, the BRI didn't exist. The last starting. 8 years have been really, really, really good for China.
It's I'm pretty sure he's making up as they go. I'm pretty sure he's making up. It's like, they weren't able to do time travel with China movies until Looper came out.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they're just making it up as they go, really.
This also comes, you know, after she's done his first kind of... Not term, but he's established in there. And this is what policy is now. Overtly peacekeeping. And
of course, the person that steals the artifact, he has an English name.
Mm.
His name is Jones. So yeah. It's like, no Chinese person would do that. I mean, only a person, a Western person would do that. He gets lectured by JJ's like, you shouldn't be doing those things, all right?
If this movie had come out like 10 years earlier, though... Or, okay, maybe like 11 years earlier, Jones
Jackie
would have been
played. Jones.
No. Yeah. Jones would be played by JC.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe.
Reprise from Railroad Tigers instead of getting arrested.
That doesn't
JC
sound
can handle a role like this.
I don't know if he could do the action. He's like, he could be the techie guy. He'd be more funny as the techie guy. The X-Files 2 guy.
Oh, yeah. I wish they'd use other characters more. Like, that guy wasn't important. The other TA wasn't important. It was just such a simple plot with, like... You have these five characters and you just follow them around. Nobody really wins.
For a film called Coffee Yoga, how many times was yoga even brought up?
Well, there was that thing with, I'm going to teach you to hold your breath underwater. You first do this, and like she spends like 30 seconds explaining it, and Jackie's like, I'm going to do it my way, and he starts hyperventilating.
Before that, there's like one person doing the yoga, and then the Chinese girl was like, oh, I'll do it as well, and then it almost seems like a contest.
There's about as much yoga in this movie as in The Lion King.
It's very brief. It's like, we just need it for the title.
Right, we need something that's vaguely Indian.
Yeah, you can make that Buddhism-like link. That was kind of cringe. Yeah, all the little bits of, like, history being told at you are just kind of cringe.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But it's not as cringe as in Chinese Zodiac, where there's, like, one scene set in a mansion, and the French lady's talking about how the artifact was taken, and then Jackie Chan jumps in, and it takes, like, 5 minutes, this whole entire scene.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we should reclaim the artifact. Oh, no, we should return it. Oh, we should bring it back to the people. And it takes like 5 minutes. It's ages.
Yeah.
Yeah, ethics and movies don't go well together.
Well, what's nice about Kung Fu Yoga, though, I think, is that it doesn't really have a strong message. Like, at the end of Chinese Zodiac, it's dedicated to the people restoring China's treasures to China. You know, like, this one is dedicated to dancing, I guess. Like, I don't know what it's dedicated to. I don't think it has.
There's no real point here, I think. Like, there's no good reason for Jackie Chan to have been, like, the history consultant for this ages-long Indian drama.
Maybe it's, like, a Brotherhood of Nations thing?
I don't know. I just wish they thought it through a little bit more, maybe. I don't know.
It was so anticlimactic at the end. It's like, what? We're at the end already? Like, they just stopped fighting when people showed up.
You learned your lesson.
Like, instantly dance. Which was very Bollywood.
Yeah.
What? It just came out of nowhere. Like, what? We're over already?
Roll credits.
At, like, an hour 47 in, that was good. That was good timing. I don't think I needed more plot.
Before I rewatched the movie, I was looking at the runtime. I was like, okay, how long is this movie? And I looked it up on Google or something, and it said 2 hours and 7 minutes. I'm like, what?
Oh,
no way! I'm like, get out of here. I'm not watching you. And I look at it, and it's like, oh, an hour 47. Okay.
Yeah, right. Okay,
20 minutes are pivotal.
Yeah, exactly.
And 20 less minutes would have been even, you know, chef's kiss. Perfect.
There probably would have been, 20 minutes cut footage? Probably, like, more wolf fighting or more lions vomiting or
I mean, I guess like the thing is, I think this movie is about the right length because it's just confusing enough. Like, I don't need them to put in 20 minutes of context, but also so much happens in this movie that if you cut out 20 minutes, I guess it's easy to cut stuff. But also, like, you would actually lose plot. I think it's not tight conceptually, but it is tight in, just in terms of, like, thing happens. It's not like you were saying that Chinese Zodiac scene.
Yeah, it doesn't even try. Thanks to Harris Thang for joining us. Up next is our interview with composer Nathan Wang.
I got very lucky. I had a very good friend who introduced me to Stanley Tong. And Stanley and I immediately hit it off. He's from Hong Kong, and I do speak a little bit of Cantonese. My Cantonese is good. My Mandarin really sucks. So I'm still struggling when I go to Beijing and China. But in terms of speaking and conversing with Stanley, it's always been no problem. And the first time he and I got together, we really did hit it off. And it was so much fun talking to him. He wanted to hire me to do Rumble in the Bronx. And since then, I think we've done about four or five other movies, along with UFA, which was the general in China, and that turned out to be a very big TV show. And ever since then, it's Jackie Chan movies. And because Stanley and I hit it off, and he speaks the music language, so it's very easy to converse with him and get sort of his feedback, and I kind of know where he wants to go. Being able to kind of put everything together and keeping him satisfied has gotten me to where I've been. The last one that we just did was called Vanguard, but unfortunately it hasn't come out because of the virus. It was supposed to come out during Spring Festival, Chinese New Year.
Yeah, we saw that the only place it's released right now is Saudi Arabia, which is insanity.
Has it already been released in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, that's, IMDb, that's the only place. So,
yeah. Right. Yeah, however right IMDb is.
Yeah, that actually wouldn't surprise me because I think one of Stanley's best friends is a sheik in Dubai. And so it wouldn't surprise me if it did actually get released in the Middle East before anyplace else.
So that part of the movie was pretty accurate then.
It's a fun movie. It's typical Stanley Tong and typical Jackie. Jackie's still full of, you know, his ebullient self and doing crazy things. But it's so interesting because he himself makes fun of himself. It's just this one instance which just cracks me up, and I'm sure it's going to crack up the entire audience when it comes, is that he's chasing this villain throughout the entire shopping mall in Dubai, and it's really fun. And, you know, they're going up the stairs, and it's elevators and all of this, and then the villain, who's very athletic, jumps something like three stories from where he is down to the ground floor. And so Jackie kind of, okay, he's getting prepared to make the same jump, and the police inspector comes, who's also been chasing the villain, and says, you know, there's an elevator. He goes, oh, okay. And it's so funny because the way he did it, you usually see him jumping the three stories, but because of this, he knows it. He's kind of handing over the reins to some of the younger generation actors, literally in this Vanguard movie, which I think is kind of setting itself up to be sort of a franchise. He's really highlighting and featuring the younger generation. And so he kind of makes fun of himself and, you know, goes to the elevator.
What was he like when you first met him on Rumble in the Bronx?
Well, to tell you the truth, really, I've only met him on several occasions. And Rumble in the Bronx was my first time working for him and with Stanley. And during that particular film, because he's on production and he's filming, I really didn't have a chance to work with him because basically I started doing the post-production and then he started going on to doing other movies. But there was the movie Who Am I? I had two or three meetings with him about that, and that was really, really a lot of fun. That one I did get to meet with him, and I'll tell you a story where he was in the Beverly Hills Hotel and he called me the night before saying, hey, I want to talk to you about the script. And I figured, oh, it's only going to be about 20 minutes or 30 minutes long, telling me about the script and kind of telling me what his ideas would be for the music. And so I go up there. It's like 10 or 11 in the morning. It was 4 hours afterwards. Walked out of the room. Why? Because he was literally showing me all the stunts that he was going to do. And it was hilarious because he would say, Nathan, I'm going to do a handstand and start walking around. And that's literally, I'm watching Jackie in front of me literally doing that. And then he took it even so far as to saying, Nathan, I'm going to pick up this chair. And you have to remember that we're in the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, right? In the penthouse suite. And so he picks up the chair, which is like made of oak. And he says, Nathan, I'm going to toss it up in the midair, and then I'm going to get on my hands and I'm going to start twirling it with my feet. And literally, that's what he does. And it's like watching the circus. And he's doing that. And as he's doing that, he's talking to me. And he says, Nathan, I'm going to kick the chair up, and then I'm going to smash it on the side of the wall. So literally, he does that. And then it smashes on the wall, and it breaks into like 1,000 pieces. And then he's showing me all sorts of other stunts. And so by the time I walked out of there, it was like, it looked like World War II. It was shattered with furniture, and I was so surprised nobody called the police because they were hearing all those crazy noises and breaking of furniture. But it was, you know, that's the kind of experience that I usually have with Jack. He's such a fun guy to be with. There was one time when I was in Beijing, and I think it was for Chinese Zodiac. He and I had actually already talked quite a bit. He loves to tease. There was one time when Stanley, Jackie, and I were sitting around and just having lunch, you know, doing chopsticks in between break and going back and filming. And Jackie was just kind of talking, and I noticed that there was a fly that was going around, just buzzing around. I think it was the middle of summer. And Jackie, unlike the Karate Kid, do you remember Mr. Miyagi who gets the chopstick?
Yeah, yep.
It didn't happen like that. But instead, what I didn't know was that there was that, you've seen it, I'm sure, those small little like tennis rackets that are electric. He literally did that, and the fly was about 1/4 inch away from my nose, and I heard this little boop, and then the fly was gone, the electric tennis racket was in Jackie's hand, and the biggest smile was on his face. So you can imagine what that was like.
So when you were talking about the new movie Vanguard and that scene where he's going and taking the elevator instead of doing the jump that you expect from him, you know, it got me thinking, there's such a canon of Jackie Chan movies that they can get to the point of being self-referential. So I'm wondering, in your scoring, when you work on these Jackie Chan movies, how much of that inspiration just is coming from, like, the tradition of Jackie Chan movie scores? And were they something that you grew up on? Where does that inspiration come from when you are trying to put music to all of these crazy stunts that he's doing?
Well, it goes back to sort of my days when I was in high school. Every Sunday I would go to church. I would be the church organist. And then, crazy enough, in the evening I would go see a kung fu movie where people are pulling out blood and guts and everything. So every Sunday, literally, there are 3 Chinese theaters in Chinatown here in Los Angeles, Sing Lei, Wado, and Gum Seng. 3 Chinese theaters, which would inevitably be playing a kung fu movie, which my mom would only let me see. She didn't want me to see any romantic or love movies. Go see the blood and guts things. So that's what I did literally every Sunday. And so I grew up with Chinese movies, and little would I have thought that I would be making a career doing Chinese movies and exactly what I grew up wishing I could do, which is, wow, wouldn't it be fun writing music for Chinese movies? And here I am kind of living off the dream. And just in terms of approaching scoring in general, let me just kind of play you. The theme for Vanguard is very simple. It's just... So just like Mission Impossible.
Careful, don't get us sued.
And you already know that it's Mission Impossible, right? So, you know, Vanguard, when Stanley and I discussed it, hopefully he's expecting it to be a spin-off, he also said, hey, Nathan, let's create something that is going to be identifiable, something that has sort of a signature, a music signature to it. So we came up with this. And what you can do with that is you can make it very playful. Or it could be your action theme. Thank you. all sorts of things with it. And as a music composer, that's the fun of it. Being able to kind of come up with a melody. And I try to do that almost in every single movie that I do. You had mentioned Chinatown Detective, not a Jackie Chan movie, but that one is also sort of in the vein of a Mission Impossible. That is... And again, that allows itself to be so much fun because, as you know, the Wang Bo and Liu Haoren characters are so much fun as detectives that you're going back and forth. I think that that theme serves its purpose really well. Being able to be flexible enough to be humorous, at the same time mysterious, because you can really have a lot of fun with it. If you think about it, putting percussion in. It's kind of like the sneaky thing, which they have a lot in, as you probably know. And so I try to find themes and melodies that will be able to be flexed around and just kind of disjointed as well, and being able to just kind of twist it all the time to be able to fit some of the scenes that we want to try to do. And hopefully predominantly, once you walk out of the movie, you'll have those themes sort of stuck in your head unconsciously.
At what stage in Kung Fu Yoga were you involved?
From the very beginning. It's interesting because Stanley, again, is a very musical person. He loves to sing. There have been times when I've gone to karaoke places where all I do is sit there and watch him sing for 3 hours. Literally. If not with a band of people, it's just me and him. And he wants to sing. And I'm just there eating the fruit and smiling away and encouraging him and trying to find songs that he knows. And he just loves music. And so in terms of Kung Fu Yoga, he got me on board rather quickly, so much so that we were able to develop a lot of things for that.
How often did you go over to China while you were developing this score?
With the technology that we have these days, I went to China probably once for Kung Fu Yoga. But there was 1 year that I went back to China 8 times in 1 year, which is ridiculous because it was a lot of back and forth. But a lot of directors want to have that face-to-face. Stanley, because we've been partners for such a long time, I think over 25 years now, he feels as though I get his music, and I think I do get what he wants. So in regards to Kung Fu Yoga, I think I only went back once, and it was really for the mix, if I'm not mistaken. So just in terms of developing things, we talk on the phone a lot. And luckily, through WeChat, I've saved a lot of money in terms of long-distance calls. Thank you for WeChat.
Has Jackie got more involved with the scores for the movies as the years have gone on, like for Chinese Zodiac and then eventually for this movie, Kung Fu Yoga?
No, I have to say that a lot of the times he's just constantly, constantly working. So once he finishes one movie, I'm just amazed how he's just jumped onto his next movie and his next project. So for me, he rarely stays around for post-production. And I think it's, again, due to the history that we have, that he feels as though it's in good hands with Stanley and the music that I've done for him.
You know, we've heard just from other conversations we've had that scenes in this movie and also Chinese Zodiac and, I mean, a lot of Chinese films, it sounds like, are improvised on set or reworked in the process of shooting. So can you just walk us through scoring a movie like this where you're really not sure what the end product is going to look like and how you adapt to that as you're writing the music?
That's a great question because, yes, in all probability, Jackie Chan movies are really never done when I get the movie. They always say, oh, yeah, we're like 99% there, and, you know, when you score it, it's going to be fine. In regards to this latest movie, Vanguard, I already finished scoring to version 5.1. Believe it or not, there was a 7.1 that had to be finished, and that was the end product, a version 7.1 versus a 5.1, which is the one that I scored. And mind you, not only am I scoring, and I'm not necessarily doing everything through the computer, but I've actually gone over and recorded at a big studio with about 40 pieces, you know, with strings and everything. So I cannot change the music. And that's where I have to hire fantastic help. And luckily, I had a wonderful music editor by the name of Po Lin, who I've worked with many times. In fact, he worked on Chinese Zodiac, Kung Fu Yoga, as well as this Vanguard movie, where because the music's already been set to a particular scene that I score to, once the film has changed and they've sent us the new picture, Ho, my music editor, has to cut it up and to make it musical sense. So not only does it go through many, many iterations of the music, but he has to put everything together. It's almost like Humpty Dumpty. Humpty Dumpty, it gets broken, they put it back together again, you have to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's how crazy it gets. And also, mind you, there's a deadline. So, you know, we're working 3, 4 a.m. in the morning, which is not unusual, and it's actually okay because I'm usually up 3, 4 o'clock in the morning talking to China and talking to the directors and other people that I have to. So it's not out of the ordinary that I stay up to 3 or 4 in the morning, but that's basically our schedule.
So both Chinese Zodiac and Kung Fu Yoga are very much fun for the whole family type of movies, big entertainments, but they also seem to carry a political message. With Chinese Zodiac, obviously the return of Chinese art. With Kung Fu Yoga, cooperation between nations. Do those elements ever play into your scores?
Well, it does in the sense that the backdrop, as you mentioned, Kung Fu Yoga takes place in India. So it was so much fun hiring a sitar player, being able to get into those ethnic music instruments and be able to kind of broaden my horizon in regards to complementing the movie. As you'll see in Vanguard, you know, it starts in London, ends up, I think, in China, but it literally geographically goes all over the world, you know, Dubai, I think Egypt, and it tries to be sort of like the Mission Impossible or a 007, where, oh, this is cool. Next scene, you know, you're in a country, and you feel like, you know, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, you're here, you're over here, you're over here, you're over here, and it does capture that element. So as a composer, you need to complement the movie. You can't just stay in one genre. You have to kind of mold it to the geography of where you are, which is so much fun. As I said, with some of these themes that I've come up with, you all of a sudden hear it in a different tone and different tonality because of the geography. So in fact, I remember in Kung Fu Yoga, when we first meet the young Indian lady who I think pretends to be the scientist, we have this. That's very Western. The melody is very Western, but there's some subtleties to it, I think, in the movie, whereby I started adding the sitar and the Indian flute. So again, it's the twists and turns that you can have so much fun with as a composer. And when you watch the movie, you kind of score to literally what's going on screen.
Staying on the politics and music theme, I wanted to ask you what it's like to compose a symphony and a concerto for a crowd that includes President Xi, and perhaps your experience as a Chinese American, like how that makes the experience different as opposed to somebody who might be raised on the mainland?
That's a very good question. If you're referring to the piano concerto I was supposed to write for Lang Lang that was going to be for the Chinese military parade, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, in 2015?
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, that actually didn't happen. I did write the piano concerto. We were having talks with Lang Lang's representative because he was going to be out there playing my piano concerto while the military is walking, stepping alongside, and President Xi looking at the entire crowd. All of that, that literally was the visual and what was supposed to happen. Unfortunately, which is very usual in China, politics takes place and certain things come up, and that was totally dropped. I already wrote everything. I already wrote the piano concerto. I had everything prepped in terms of the scores for the orchestra, for the pianist. Everything was done. I wasn't surprised when that happened because there have been so many times where I've had those particular instances happen, particularly in China. So that's where politics comes into play, and I just dutifully do what I'm supposed to do, but other things supersede it.
Could you comment on being in those situations as a Chinese American rather than as a mainland Chinese? Do you think that changes it?
Yes, I think it does change. I was born and raised here in Los Angeles, in California, in the United States. So I am through and through American, but my history is also obviously of Chinese heritage, and my mom and father grew up in Shanghai. And so I do have that kind of pull with China. I am proud to be Chinese American because I certainly don't deny my Chinese heritage, which I'm very proud of. But at the same time, I am not political. I am very, very much steeped into music. But I think that if I were through and through Chinese, there would be a lot of things that would be able to happen in China that I am not part of, which is okay because I'm over here and I'm over there. It doesn't really bother me. If I were living in China, I'm sure that I would be getting a lot of other movies in terms of the Chinese entertainment industry. There are also some political movies that are being made and that I'm being considered for that are not necessarily political movies, but government-sponsored movies, government-based movies, mm-hmm. Government-invested movies. And those I'm totally a part of. So I thank my lucky stars that I am part of the Chinese entertainment industry and that I can make a career and have a good reputation in China as being a music composer over there. But I'm here as an American here in the United States, and I'm proud of what I'm doing over there and being here in Hollywood. That's something that I'm trying to balance.
That's a cool. Mm-hmm.
In your inspirations for your music, where do contemporary trends in Chinese music come in? Do you do a lot of research into what's popular music-wise in China, or is it really coming from a pure film score background?
I do a lot of research because something that I see myself as is a complete composer. And that doesn't mean just film scoring. It means writing, you know, Chinese pop music. It also mm-hmm. means, you mentioned earlier, classical music. So as a musician and as a composer, I want to be involved in as many genres as possible. And because I am so steeped in China in terms of my reputation, I need to know what's going on over there. So I do a lot of research. And one of the things, do you know who Dimash is? A wonderful, wonderful Kazakhstan singer who has also been able to make his mark in China. He's Vitas, do you know Vitas, the Russian singer? Who has literally a voice and a range higher than the highest soprano can sing.
Wow.
And deep sensation. If you haven't heard of him, definitely look out on his YouTube. Well, I was so impressed with him. And apparently the feeling was mutual in terms of his being so wanting to work with Jackie that I was wishing and hoping that I'd have a chance to work with Dimash at the very same time. He was hoping and wishing that he could be involved in a Jackie Chan movie. And somehow the stars aligned and he got in touch with me and I got in touch with his manager. And I was able to, in fact, have him sing our end credit song on Vanguard. Again, I won't spoil the ending of the movie, but it's a big celebration. It's kind of like Kung Fu Yoga. Remember when
they dance sequence?
We're not going to fight anymore. Let's go ahead. Okay.
It's Bollywood time.
Breaking to Bollywood. Here we go. So pretty much the same thing happens with this movie. And we have Dimash singing. And he's such a phenomenon as a superstar singer and as a gentleman and someone who's super, super humble that I'm really proud to call him a friend.
You were talking about being sort of a complete composer, and it seemed interesting to me that the opening of Kung Fu Yoga, obviously the visuals are very video gamey. Was the music also meant to sort of evoke video games of a certain era?
Yes and no. Honestly, when I was watching it the very, very first time, again, this kind of goes back to your previous question. When I see the movie, it's certainly not done. You know, there's green screens. There were no elephants in the opening. I had no idea, honestly, what was going on in the first, literally, it's like, what, 6-7 minutes?
Yeah.
It just keeps going on and on and on. It almost went to an animatic, which is almost just the next step from the storyboard. So I'm just seeing these drawings, these crude drawings, which ultimately end up, as you said, sort of like a video game, which looks really cool. So to be very honest with you, I had no idea what the ultimate the visual was going to be. So I just kind of took it looking like, oh, okay, it's a battle. You know, so I created the battle action adventure feel. And that's when I think I had already come up with the melody for the entire movie. And I said, well, this is the opening scene. It's an action thing. I want to introduce the music as an action thematic thing that's going on and that would be able to follow as much as I could the animatic that I was given.
So this movie and a lot of fight-heavy movies, stunt-heavy movies, they have a lot of Foley work that plays a very prominent position in some of the more action-heavy scenes. I'm just wondering if that plays into the way you score the scenes. Do you try to, like, make room for the Foley? Do you try to incorporate that into what your score is? Or do you just sort of operate on separate tracks?
You know what? That's a great, great question, because I go immediately to my theory that when you're able to have an open dialogue with people who are not necessarily Foley, but I would say more the general sound effects that are complete in the movie. If I'm able to have an open dialogue with the sound effects people and they're able to send me tracks, then I know what's going on. One of my favorite movies is 300 that was scored by Tyler Bates. I had a wonderful, frank conversation with him. I said, you know what? I so admire your score and the way you were able to use the music and how it complemented the sound effects. And he said, you know what? I just had my conversation with the sound effects people, and he kind of confirmed what I had already been thinking, which is, can you give me, Mr. Sound Effects Person, your stems and your audio tracks that you've already created? It doesn't have to be the final. Just give me what you have, because we're working in tandem, and I don't want to be working in a box so that I'm creating something for the visuals, he's creating something for the visuals. Instead, we're going back and forth and we're coming up with something for the visuals together. So I can hear what he does and I don't step on what he's trying to do, which might be a phenomenal explosion sound. There's no need for the music to do anything if the sound effects is covering all that already, and vice versa. And so what I try to do when we go back and forth is I send QuickTimes to Stanley. I send him my cues. And as you probably know, all these cues are separated. It's not just like one big cue. So, you know, 1M16 is the 16th cue in the first reel. 3M02 is the second cue in the third reel. So whenever I finish a specific cue, I send it over to Stanley for him to hear. And also I give the same thing over to the sound editor and the special effects person. They're all pretty much in the same department. So he can hear what music I've created. And once Stanley approves it and greenlights it, I give it to my assembly line, because in these days of being a music composer, you don't work alone. There's no one who can do everything by himself, herself anymore. So I have a team where once it's been greenlit, I give my MIDI tracks, I give my music over to my prep team, who then starts putting it into notation and getting it ready for the orchestra. So once it gets greenlit, there's no going back. But going back to what I was saying, the special effects people get my audio stem. And in so doing, they get to hear what I've been emphasizing in those particular cues, and they can kind of step around it. And even before then, even before I give it to Stanley, there might be some tricky cues where I'm thinking, this part, I might really need to talk to the editors. And so what we do is we go back and forth even before I start the mock-up. So I know what is important for him or her, as well as what he knows what is important for myself from a musical standpoint.
By the end of this movie, you've integrated not only Western influences of music, but also by the end, you're goring a scene choreographed by like Farah Khan, who is basically a childhood Bollywood hero of mine. But like, how was it like to work with her and then also for potentially a Bollywood audience?
Well, I certainly had to keep that in mind, because I definitely wanted to make something that sounded authentic. But if you remember, that was an idea that Stanley had, which was to take that same song that we had used in The Myth, which was in 2005, right? That was a long, long time ago. And he wanted to make it a Bollywood song.
Wow.
And I basically had to rearrange it. So I had some wonderful talks with her, in terms of, okay, how long does this need to be, knowing full well that it's probably going to be changing. I had to talk to her to make sure that it was the right BPM for her, because when it was written for the myth, it was a ballad, right? It was a beautiful, beautiful ballad, and I'm very proud of having written that and then be able to transfer it into a Bollywood version. It certainly didn't have, it couldn't keep the same tempo. So I had to make sure that I got the right BPM in terms of the tempo for her, and also be able to make sure that the structure was different enough for her to be able to do the wonderful choreography that she did at the end of the movie.
Have you seen Stanley or Jackie offset since these movies, and how have they changed over the years of working together?
Honestly, I think the magic is still prevailing. Nothing has really changed except for the confidence that we have in each other, knowing that if we make another movie, it's just going to be another hit, because we really haven't had anything that hasn't been successful. When Stanley teams up with Jackie, it always seems like it's going to work. And luckily, Stanley's had me follow suit. So I'm very, very happy to be part of that successful team.
We started out talking about how COVID had delayed the release of Vanguard, and I think also delayed the release of Detective Chinatown 3.
It did. It did. And those were my two major movies
of the year.
Yeah, seriously. I'm so lucky in the fact that I've always been able to be positioned in the sense that I don't think that I've missed very many spring festivals. As you know, that's like our Christmas time here in Hollywood, where you save your big, big movies to be released. And I've been able to be part of that, so that pretty much every spring festival, I've been lucky enough to have a major movie come out. And it's really a pity, because not only did I have one, but I had two, and they did get delayed. So I'm going to see what happens, because you probably know better than I that they tried to open the Chinese theaters. And they opened it for 1 or 2 days, and then they closed it, and they thought, you know what, this is not a very good idea. So they kind of turned tail. And there is talk that they might release it online. There's also talk that I heard from Stanley's team that they might want to try to save it for next spring festival.
Oh, wow.
Which is,
oh, wow.
Yeah, which is kind of a long wait, but there you have it.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's really going to happen with those two movies. Obviously, they're huge movies, no matter how you look at it. So it'll still have a big following. I just don't know what platform it's going to come out.
Yeah. How does all of this, do you think, affect your future in terms of scoring? Do you think you'll focus on, I mean, I don't know if there's anywhere where movies can be released at the moment, but.
Well, as I said, honestly, it doesn't really matter what genre I'm in, whether it's classical music, writing a piano concerto, whether it's writing for video games or television or movies. So even if this ends up as online, it's okay with me. I'm just very proud of the product that I was able to do and to work on. That's the satisfaction that I get in working with these great directors like Ming Hao and Su Youfeng. I always have the great satisfaction of being able to say, great, they're happy. And once they're happy with the music, I don't care where it comes out. So it's a pity that it didn't have its grand opening, which, you know, the red carpet and all that. But it's okay, as long as I've done my job. And in the end, they're happy, I'm happy.
Thank you so much for this interview and the live music.
Oh, so amazing.
Yeah, it's really incredible.
I appreciate that. You know what? I really appreciate your saying that, because I hope that in a way soundtracks, which have always been sort of overlooked in China and just kind of fluffed off, not necessarily saying that the music has been not good. It's just that there hasn't ever been an emphasis on the soundtrack, on the music. And I'm so happy to hear that you have these kinds of podcasts that will be able to kind of encourage people to be more enthusiastic about listening to music. And I think the more you do that, I think people are going to go, they're going to sit up and not only get so steeped and involved in the movie, but hopefully, you know, they'll go back a second time and go, wow, what's going on here? Why is this a successful movie? Why am I getting so emotionally involved and invested? And hopefully they'll be able to, little by little, see that music has a lot to do with it. Obviously, it's happened here in America, I think, because it has had the history of these phenomenal, phenomenal composers going all the way back to Bernard Herrmann, you know, and Hitchcock scores and all those. If you think about it, China in its inception, and for my inception, I consider it literally around 2005, 2008. That's when I got personally involved going back to Beijing, working on the Olympics. And I think that that's when things started to happen. And I was able to work on Sophie's Revenge, if you know that movie with Zhang Ziyi. And that's when, you know, that movie came out and it was like a big blockbuster hit. It made 100 million RMB, which if a movie comes out and makes 100 million RMB now, right. Yeah. Complete flop. Yeah. They're up 6.8 million now, right? So I'm glad to see that things are going in the right direction for Chinese movies. And I hope that in its incline, that it also carries music along with it, because I think the more people understand how important film score is, the more the younger generation composers are going to be able to go, I want to do that. And there's so much talent in China that I'm just hoping that this, what I've done, can be an encouragement for the younger generation to be able to go, I want to do that too.
That's really interesting. Last season, we ended up talking to Joseph Trapanese, who did Wolf Warrior 2.
Yeah, great composer, fun score, fun movie.
And very nice guy. But what he told us that I found sort of interesting was that, from his understanding, the standard for Chinese movies was that the scores would be done very quickly often. Do you think that's been changing as the blockbusters have gotten sort of bigger and bigger?
Yes. The very quick answer is yes. Because I think more and more Chinese directors are coming over here, going through the process of what it takes to make a really good movie. Before 1996, let's say, I don't think there were that many Chinese young students who came over, literally studied film in the university or at USC or any other large educational institution and understood the process. They were just kind of going for it, going through the historical way of how Chinese used to make a movie, which is not quite the same way that Hollywood did it. And drawing just from my own background of Sophie's Revenge that started in 2008, the production value has gone up.
Yeah.
I think there's no doubt, and it's pretty factual, that the production value is going up and up. And what's part of that production value? Music. And what's part of production value getting better is understanding that post-production is just as important as production, right? You know, all of these facets are so important. And I think that as you go along for Chinese, for the entertainment industry, they're learning that, hey, when you make a Wolf Warrior, you've got to have all this big sound. You've got to be, you can't rush through it, man. And I think that just looking again from my background, I've spent a lot more time on Vanguard, on Kung Fu Yoga, than I did with Rumble or with The Myth. They're learning. Stanley's learning. We're all learning that the more you give to the time and back after production, the better the entire production is going to be in terms of the end result. And I think that that's an important lesson to be learned. And they're learning it because they're learning the Hollywood process. And obviously, they want to make a Hollywood blockbuster, and that's what they've done.
Obviously, we're huge fans of these more recent movies, but do you think there's anything that's lost in this Hollywoodization of them?
Well, I think, like everything, I'm a big fan of contemporary music that's going on right now, but what about the Beatles? Right. Right? What about the Whitney Houstons back in the 80s? There was something about that vintage sound that you can say has been lost through the process of the production getting so perfect these days. I mean, when you look at and hear a Beatles song, you have to realize that that was recorded at Abbey Road Studios with two microphones up there, you know, and Paul, John, Ringo, and George just doing their thing. But they're only like two microphones. Now, what do? You know, we've got a drum kit that has probably like 17 microphones just on the drum kit, right? And everything's going through direct boxes. And then after that, it's going through a compressor, it's going through this, and you're tweaking everything, and you come up with something that sounds phenomenal, like these production songs, like, I don't know, Taylor Swift and Bruno Mars, their production values are just unbelievable. And it's because they're working with the fantastic producers who spend so much time getting like the tambourine sound exactly the way they want it. There's something to that that makes it successful. But on the other hand, there's something that's so charming that we've lost, and I think we really have lost it, that's so successful when you listen to a Beatles song or any of those kinds of songs that have lasted through the years.
Or an old Jackie Chan movie, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The Police Stories, right?
Yeah.
Phenomenal. And yeah, they have its own charm. When you think about Vanguard, when you see it, or Kung Fu Yoga, it has its own charm. So I would say that it's changed, but there's still something that attracts you to it. And the attraction might be, it's different. It's a different kind of charm. And I think you have to kind of see it that way.
Yeah. Thanks to Nathan Wang. Up next is our interview with stuntman Tomer Oz.
I was wearing my Jackie Chan t-shirt. I was like,
nice. Like,
could you tell us about opening up your Muay Thai gym in China and if that's what led you to meeting Jackie Chan eventually?
Sure. It's a good question, actually, because this is exactly what there was the process. Yeah, so after finished my training in Thailand, I moved to China and opened my Muay Thai gym. Because that time there was no Muay Thai legit gym in Shanghai. I opened the first one and immediately it was making a big noise. And luckily, so it's create my name a little bit out of the regard martial art industry. About the year after I opened my gym, He Jun, which is the leader of the action team in Jackie Chan, he did a casting for the movie Chinese Zodiac. Which Chinese Zodiac was a Jackie Chan movie that he produced and directed, and he was acting and charged of a lot of things. I heard about this casting, and an agent that I didn't even know recommend them to see me in my own gym. And I thought it was a bluff because, you know, like Jackie Chan is my idol. And I was like, there's no way he would come to my gym with the team. But they appear the day after in my gym for a casting. So I met He Jun. He cast me, he cast my student. He said, can you do that? Can you do that? And I said, yes. And we got along very well. I did a few flips, a few reaction of hits. It was my first time actually, and he really liked it, and they left. I didn't hear from them for 6 months, and I thought at that time that I didn't get it because there's no way, but I felt very good in that casting. So, and I heard that they start doing the preparation for the films. I felt weird that they didn't call me, so I asked that agent, but he, you know, this agents in China, it's just another story. So I tried to contact a guy that I know the casting director. And I said, can you check with her that if they really didn't like me or something like that? Because I felt really good in this casting. He contacted her, my friend, Tom. And Amy contacted He Jun. And she said, do you know this guy, Tomer, you have a gym? And He Jun was like, yes, I couldn't find him. I lost his agent. Where is he? Tell him he's in. I want him in the film. And this was the best news I ever got. And 4 months later, I was invited to Jackie Chan film, Chinese Zodiac. Yeah.
Did you ever have any plans or had you planned going into movies or film at all? Or was this really just opportunity and you ran with it?
To be honest, I you know how we are. We love martial art, and I grew up on Jackie film and Bruce Lee and Van Damme and all that. I always wanted to do, and I always wanted to show my skill on the screen. Yes, I always aim and manifest for that. I didn't know it will come through my gym. Let's try to get an agent. I'm in China. You know, there's all these kung fu movies here I would like to do, but it never was my main goal. But definitely, I wanted to, and I pushed for opportunity, but this opportunity came to me. So that's the funny thing. it was just too much overwhelm, like, yeah, to work with Jackie, to even be invited to his set.
When you finally met him, what was your first impression?
I got first into, yeah, in Chinese Zodiac. We went on the set, we did the costumes. Before I know, I'm a pirate and I'm on the set. And I just couldn't wait to see Jackie because, you believe it or not, one time I flew to Hong Kong before I moved to China just to maybe see him in the street, because I hear he was walking on the street. I was like that crazy about him. And suddenly he's coming on the set and we're all standing in line, all the pirates. It's 10 foreigner guys, martial artists. And Jackie is coming and he shake all of our hands and he's like, welcome to my show. It was immediately, I mean, I saw his kind and personality, and I saw how he's talking to the team and behind the set and helping everybody, and very humble, always laughing. And it's exactly the Jackie Chan I expected and thought I will see from the films. Even after working with him and start to chat with him, and I just even admire him more before.
You do some fun physical comedy as a pirate in Chinese Zodiac. Did you learn any of that from Jackie?
I always mix martial art with comedy. I don't know if you saw, I even did this fight challenge recently and different films. And I love comedy, and I always was the clown in the gym or in the, you know, when I'm with friends. So Jackie definitely inspired me and his movies, and I knew that they're doing comedy. So I aimed for that and I pushed for that in my scene. That even the next film, I also did try to do comedy, but they are like, no, stop right here, because this time it's more serious. So like on Dragon Blade. And I knew that this is how Jackie perform, and I pushed for that a bit.
Has your beard or having a beard ever affected the roles you could play, this kind of roles that you get cast for?
You know, in China, they really like my beard. Like, I actually keep my beard, and I have to be careful with that because it's covering my face. And every time when I grow a beard before a film, they're like, okay, keep it. So I think I'm going to start to grow it a bit late. So... But for Chinese Zodiac, for example, they shaved and just kept my mustache, you know, because it was funnier. But yeah, usually they like the characters look very strong with the beard. You look a bit more mature. They don't have much hairy guys there. So
this is the perfect time to start growing the beard.
Yeah.
We heard from Brahim Chaub that the Dragon Blade shoot was just incredibly tiring and kind of crazy. The set, how grueling was it for you?
Dragon Blade, I was super excited just to have that role, like next to Jackie Chan, that I didn't really mind anything. It was very tiring once we went to the desert, but I always keep in my mind, remember what I asked for, what this opportunity, and I didn't take it as granted to be with Jackie Chan team, in Jackie Chan team, getting a role on the movie set. And I keep reminding myself how great opportunity it is. And even when we have harder time, because it's long hours and we're in the desert, I'm like, Tomer, remember when you're 16 and you see Jackie Chan movies in the desert and all this kind of period films, you're in it, so shut up. So that's how I get motivated. The hardest thing for me there was the food. Yeah, that's the hardest part because, you know, it's in the desert and they send us food from I don't know where. And you get those plastic boxes that always taste the same every day for breakfast, lunch, dinner, you know, it doesn't matter. And that's for me was the hardest. You know, the nutrition as an action actor, we need good nutrition on set. So this is what everybody keep complaining. I think that's why I came to Hollywood, just to get better food on set. To be honest. I know, it's funny, but that's for me was really hard. You know?
Was Jackie eating the same food?
Yeah, Jackie's sitting with us, eating the food. know, he's sitting with us. He doesn't care. You know, he has, sometimes he's in the trailer. Sometimes he's just sitting with us, eating. And he likes to be part of the team. You know, you never see him separate from us. It's nice to see. It really inspires everybody. It really, even in Dragon Blade, there was a part, you know, there were so many extras. They're very tired, you know, in the sun, and they admire Jackie. And then they just, one of them in the middle of the scene, take his phone outside and start to shoot Jackie, you know. Mm-hmm. So immediately everybody's screaming on this guy, and the guy start to cry, and Jackie just like, everybody stop, just stop right now. And he said, don't scream on him, don't, because the guy start to cry. So Jackie was like, this, just very educating, tell the guy, look, I know it's your first film. I know you want to take a moment of this part. Please don't do it. It's not, we cannot show it in the media. He showed it in a very polite way. And he said, don't cry. Everything is okay. Everything is fine. He said, everybody leave him alone. He said, please don't do it again. That's it. And we continue, you know, it's just like that.
How long were you in the desert for on that film?
I think about 30, 40 days.
Wow.
Yeah. In the desert, yeah, something like that. It's beautiful there.
Do you think growing up in Israel sort of prepared you more than most people for that sort of set?
For the desert? Yeah, for me, I didn't really. I like that kind of land. I like the view. I like the idea that we're shooting actually in the desert and not in the studio. I even told Daniele, the director, I really appreciate the way you shoot, because he very. Daniele is a director that came from art background. And I really respect that he actually shoot in the nature there, and going to deep locations to shoot a beautiful scene, which is take much harder than a studio. But yeah, I was in the army, and you know, we marched through the desert a lot, so it didn't bother me. I'm not gonna lie, we had hard times there. Sometimes just waiting, or you know, it's very hot, and we wear those big costumes. I guess you guys saw the costume is huge. So it is hot, and yeah, we don't have iced coffees there or stuff like that, you know. So, you know, but in the end of the day, we're shooting a film and we work, you know, it's a job.
Did the cast and everybody working on the film hang out or see each other off set?
Yeah, it's a very good, how can I say, it's like a brotherhood between all the stunt action performers. We, you know, we have days off. When we go back to the hotel, we hang. We're in a city, and it's called, I forget, Don Juan. It's sometimes we take a trip. We just like, okay, we have 2 days off. We're going to this oasis, you know, and ride camels, whatever. It was really fun. Some of the, yeah, main cast, not Jackie, because he's busy, but other guys. Yeah, we definitely stay together outside the set. Yeah. A lot of jokes running around, yeah.
What sort of jokes?
I mean, between, you know, all the action actors, stunt people, you know, we hang out together in the same room. It's feel like back in the army. I mean, we don't sleep in the same room. We just like hang together all the time, and going to the local markets and filming and doing our own behind the scene film, you know, and just creating our own fight scene just for fun.
How early in the process did you get involved with Kung Fu Yoga?
Like, were you working on pre-production, helping them set up fights, or did you come in on the set?
Sometimes they ask me to come to the Jackie Chan stunt school, the stunt team. Mm-hmm. And I do sometimes. But, and for Kung Fu Yoga, they also asked me to come a little bit before, but I had my own gym and I couldn't leave because I was teaching there as well. Wu Gang is also an action director for Jackie Chan team. There's two action directors, Wu Gang and He Jun. Mm-hmm. And now Gong Hua as well. But Wu Gang was, you know, Jackie team, luckily, they just calling me. They told me, we have a film, are you available? And that's it. They trust that I can learn on the set and I can learn a few days before. So they brought me, I think, 2 days earlier. We do some choreography. And I know Jackie's style sometimes is changing just on the set, different combo. And you have to always be sharp. You have to be quick. You have to be, because it doesn't matter, even you study the choreography, suddenly they are like, okay, we're changing it. And you have to be ready for that, and they trust me that I can do it, and that's it. So actually, most of the, to be honest, the fights, and I remember that we did on Kung Fu Yoga, I studied probably a few hours before because we changed it. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just like that. You have to be ready. You know, it's very Jackie style. This is why I like to come to here, Hollywood, because here they actually, they can do even a month before choreography. So mm-hmm. I will be like, yeah, that's great. I mean, please, you know. But
is there an advantage to working the way Jackie does, where, like, you know, it's very actively being edited or very actively being changed? Does it make it more dynamic at all? Or do you think the planning over a longer period of time is better?
The way the Jackie do, the Jackie team do, they do train you. They do train you. For example, Dragon Blade. We had a crazy Kung Fu fight there, and it was only 3 days, but very intensive. And I never did Kung Fu in my life. So I felt not comfortable, but somehow they managed to very patiently teach me very well. So it's keep you alert, you know, they keep you very sharp, and I like it. I like the style. I feel after Jackie, I can do any film, any fight. You know, I work also with Sammo Hung for 2 films, and it's a little bit different, but similar style, the way they do it, very quick. And it's keep me very confident now that I can go on any set and prepare. But me personally, I prefer to do, let's say, a week before rehearsal, so I know exactly what I do and I can make it perfect. I was in the, you know, with all the treasure on the ground in the cave, and all the last scene I was there. I'm telling you everything. I was even shocked that Jackie did, you know, there's a way that he do like an aerial, like a flip from a step, and he learned there, take the girl. He did it himself, over 60 years old. He had the wire. But he did it himself, like one shot, boom. I was like, wow.
Were the methods of the Indian and Bollywood stuntmen different from, you know, the Chinese stuntmen and the American stuntmen you've worked with?
They brought the Indian choreographers, very famous, I forget her
Farah Khan at the end, yeah.
Yeah, so we did the dancing. That was the choreography. We had to dance.
How could you compare that with working with Jackie Chan's stunt team?
Very different. Actually, to be honest, every team I work with is very different than JC team. JC team, I feel already it's a family. I know the rhythm, a lot of smiles, a lot of laugh, and it's just very flow, and very professional in the same time. So I don't know how to explain. But other teams, you know, I don't know them, so finally you feel like, okay, let's learn their style, and it's a bit more serious and more and especially like for the dancing part in the choreography, the woman was very tough. She's like an army general there, you know. And I'm like, we're dancing, we're supposed to have fun. Like, yeah. And some people were really not a good dancer, so she had a big laugh there. Some martial artists cannot dance, some martial artists dance very well.
Where do you fall on that stuntman who can dance or can't dance?
Oh, I can dance.
Nice.
Yeah, I can dance somehow.
How was Jackie at picking up the dance moves? As far as
he is good, man. He's really good. Easy. The guy can do anything. I'm just seriously. It's not just because he's my boss. He's just good. Dancing, you know, martial art. He can pick a broom and just play with it forever. You know, yeah, chair, anything. No, he's very, very talented. It's amazing.
Have you ever seen him do anything super impressive just casually offset?
He was teaching us, actually in Kung Fu Yoga, yeah, he was teaching us some kata form, you know, for, I forget this Kung Fu form, bao. I forget it's a form that I was very impressed. It's almost like a form of Tai Chi that become very explosive with fist and aggressive. And then the way he was moving his body was very impressive. Yeah. And even when we play Hakisak, he's coming and he's like, man, he can play Hakisak. he's just good with anything he do. I'm like, that's not fair. It's so good.
Do you have any memorable, like, on offset, just, you know, hanging out casual interactions with Jackie?
The last film that it's supposed to be out on January, but because the corona is delayed, Vanguard. Yeah, I spend a lot of time with Jackie that time because I got actually a nice role in it. So we hang out a lot and we talk a lot. So I had, yeah, that was a good time to actually just be catching up normally and just talk to Jackie and finally tell him, you know, some stories and what I think, you know, and how I admire him. Because before I always like, okay, friend, but not, let's respect, let's not go and tell stories now. But in Vanguard, yeah, it was good time for me to be with him and just sit and relax and talk a little bit. And which I'm playing a very different character. And this character, I was like, let's go out of the box. Let's not go safe. Before, I always play safe and tough. And I said, let's be clumsy and let's try to be ugly. Let's try to be ugly and clumsy on the set. And the director loved it. So it's totally different character for me.
Do you finally get to play a good guy?
Never. Like, hopefully one day, maybe in Hollywood. And one thing, I don't know if you guys saw the trailer, but there is a big river scene.
I'm trying to not go down the waterfall.
Yeah. But did you hear the story? What's happened there to Jackie?
No.
Yeah. I mean, so that's not a joke. We shot 3 weeks on a whitewater rafting in Taiwan. There's some strong streams in there, you know, like the river flow. And Jackie, you know, he wanted to do everything himself, of course. And we have a scene that he saved the girl from the island and he's riding the jet ski. And he's supposed to put the girl, Mia, she's supposed to jump on the back of the jet ski and then he's supposed to leave. And Jackie did it himself. And I was just there and he's going to this fake island that they put there. And Mia, she's jumping on jet ski and he's about to go against the stream. And the jet ski just flip over and Jackie was stuck under the jet ski, between the jet ski and the fake island. And I know how strong is it. It look not so strong, the water flow, but it's very strong because I almost drowned in one scene, which it was 2 days ago. And Jackie go under and we expect him to go up and he doesn't. Mia struggling, she hold the jet ski, she's stuck between the jet ski to the fake island, and then Jackie is down, and people are screaming, Jackie? Jackie! Jackie! You know, we scream, it's a very slow second, and I start to jump, me and two more guys, we jump in, but then, okay, it's getting strong, so we pull back. Somehow, after 10 seconds, Jackie go out from the other side of the fake island that they built. I was worried because the way they build the islands is it's metal beams, you know. They put metal beams under to stuck into the ground in the sand. Mm. I was afraid he was stuck under there. But luckily he came out from the other side and immediately he was struggling and immediately the rescue teams came and took him out, you know, and took care of him. And I was freaked out because I saw a lot of things, but I was like, are we losing Jackie Chan right now? You know? So that's for me was the most memorable thing from working with Jackie. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was like, yeah, that was scary.
Did he do less intense stunts on that movie after that moment?
I think everybody took the water more serious after, but he didn't. I think he don't understand the concept of that. You know, I think he's so devoted to his job. It's like, he's just very, because when after people ask him, what did you feel? I think he even interviewed about it one time on the set. And he was saying, you know, I was very panic when I was underwater. And then I was like, okay, relax. Relax, try to figure out what's happened. And then he started to move and going to the other side on that fake little island. And he said, hold your breath and go out. So this is what he did, the way he talked about it. And then you can see he was nervous. But then after a few minutes, he started laughing like nothing happened. And you know, we had a lot of scenes still in the water, and he did all of them. He's like, yeah, I'm doing it. It's fine. It's amazing to see it. This why people see his film, but when you work with him, it's another. You really respect him because he is what you see. He is Jackie Chan. There's no fake there. There's no fake acting from him, fake action from him. It's everything real. And on top of it, he's the most nice person on set. Because when the set is very serious and Jackie Chan coming in, you feel much more relaxed and safe. That's how it is. So in every movie, sometimes the directors are very, you know, very tense, you know, and everybody scared and that. Jackie, calm, you feel safe, you feel relaxed.
Is there anybody on set who has the authority to just kind of say to Jackie, like, Jackie, maybe you shouldn't do this one by yourself or something? Like, have you ever witnessed him kind of being relegated because maybe can't handle everything?
I mean, I feel like always Jackie will have the last word because people really respect him, and he's also producers in most of his films. So, but he did, you know, of course, directors like Stanley Tong, they are good friends. They worked together before and say, hey, Jackie, let's do like this way or this way. And Jackie, of course, listening and sometimes take the advice, and he's like, yeah, okay, we'll do that way. But if Jackie really want to do something, yeah, he will do that 100%. He know exactly what he wants. So if he doesn't agree, he will say, no, we do it my way, and it's done. But he's open also to suggestions all the time. Even I suggested one time something, and he's like, yeah, let's do it. You know, like in Chinese Zodiac, yeah.
What did you suggest?
So you saw Chinese Zodiac?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you see, I'm this pirate with the mustache, right? But before that, I had the full beard. They gave me a full beard. And I was like, I told to Hejun. Hejun is the action director. I said, Hejun, I don't know, I think it's more funny, and I feel not comfortable with this big beard, you know? It's very itchy. I don't feel like, you know, I don't know why I said, I thought it would be nicer with the mustache. You know, I think they tried to do something kind of, I think they wanted every character to have some different kind of
visual,
religious. And I was like, let's just be a funny pirate, you know? And so then Hejun went to Jackie and he said, Tomer, a little bit not comfortable. I was like, whoa, don't tell Jackie. He's like, Tomer, not so comfortable with the beard. And then he's looking at me because I just met him that time. And he's like, what do you prefer? I said, just mustache. And he's like, okay, just mustache. And then they sent me back to the makeup. They took out my beard. The makeup people weren't happy because they prepared his beard forever. And yeah, that's it. And then I had this mustache and I felt so happy. I was like, Jackie, I love you.
To move away slightly from Jackie Chan, I'm wondering, how did you get involved in Sky Hunter?
I was, you know, most of my film before were only a stunt performer. I was a stunt performer, action performer. And slowly, slowly people like, hey, he's looking cool. Maybe we can put him in the front a little bit. So I did Dragon Blade, I did that and that. And, you know, I had a good showreel. That time there is an agent that I could communicate very well. And she say, hey, Tomer, there's this big film and I think they're looking for a character like you. Can you send me some stuff? I send the pictures and I just did a photo shoot, you know, with my beard and my showreel. And she saw it to the casting director. And the casting director immediately showed to the director and the producer, and they both told me after we met, they said, once they saw my picture and they're like, that's the guy, you are the character. And I got the job. So it was my first big acting.
How heavy was the PLA presence on that set?
The PL?
How many people from the Chinese army were on that set? Because it's written by, I think, lieutenant colonel.
So how many of the Chinese...
What was the military presence like, I guess?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that it was a, you know, very patriotic film, and the Chinese part was like most of the cast was actual actors and some actually we went to actual base, army base. So this where we have to be very disclosed, and we signed this contract where we cannot take photos and everything because we're in a China base. And but they cleared the base. There was not, you know, there was nothing there but just what they wanted to see for the set. You know, you see all the fighter planes flying above you, like, wow, you're in a real army base, you know. But, you know, the director, Lee Chan, it was his first film that he directed. I think few of the actors were actual soldiers, but the rest was only a Chinese cast actors. The other part, which is my army, Mabu, it's all foreign actors, you know, and which I feel like a lot of us have different accent and different dialects and different. So I was a bit confused with the foreign part.
Was the production style on that one any different in a major way from working on the Jackie movies?
Yeah, definitely. This was it was just an acting process, and I was just focusing on the acting in that, working directly with the director, a lot of direction about how he gave me the freedom to act the way I want, but just I keep working with the writer and Lee Chen, the director, regard the scenes, the acting, the changing, the production side was it was good, actually, to be honest. The production was good, very prepared, you know. We had meetings before and during shooting time. You know, in China, always the schedule change. It's always change, and you work more days or less days than what you are. In that aspect, it's the same. But the experience was very different to be on the set as an actor only. And it was nice to see, you know. It was different style of production, you know. The producer was Mr. Liu, which he's going to do another Jackie Chan film. He did Everest, I think, The Climbers with Jackie Chan, something mm-hmm. like that. And now he's going to make another film with Jackie Chan, Life of a Mercenary. I think it's also, they start shooting soon. He's, yeah, so the producer are the same. So you can see sometimes a lot of similarity in the production.
What was working with Fan Bingbing like?
Fan Bingbing, I met her before when I was shooting the Iron Man 3, the prologue. I met her before and she was very friendly, very nice. And a few years later, and now I see her again on Sky Hunter. You see, we don't have a direct scenes together, but I met her and everybody loved her. Everybody loved Fan Bingbing. There's no one person that, you know, that like her. She's very friendly, very polite. You know, she speaks clear English communication, and she did very good. I was very impressed. Yeah, I was very impressed being around her. Yeah.
How did you feel like a year or so later when she disappeared?
It felt weird.
Quarantine.
I was like, yeah. I was like, is it my bad acting? Well, why did you go? I was like, no, I don't know, because it was so strange, you know. I don't know if it's because our film or the film after she did. I mean, it doesn't maybe matter, but it felt strange because I'm like, it was just after my, you know, our film, and then you hear that this news, you know, that Fan Bingbing gone. She didn't pay whatever tax, and it's sad. It's sad because she's a big actress there. She's the most, I guess she's the number one paid actress in China or Asia. And suddenly you hear that person is gone. So it's put a very big impact on the industry for everyone in China, you know. I was still in touch with the director, Lee Chen. So it's about, you know, I never put anything to regard Fan Bingbing, you know, I never talk about that.
Yeah, it never happened.
Yeah, like it never happened, you know, you cannot.
How has moving to California affected your work with Chinese film? Do you think you'll be going back when you can soon?
Yes, I think so. I keep in touch. Actually, even yesterday I talked to Gonghua for Jackie Chan team. I think I will, but it's definitely affected because they know I'm here now. A lot of people, after I moved here, which is 1.5 years ago, I went to, on January 2010, shooting Vanguard after moving here. So I shoot one film and then I came back. that's 6 months pass, and I never hear from any other production. And then another film, which I did before moving here, called Defended War, with Robert Neppert and other actors in that. And they call me back for the second, for the sequel, for the second movie. So I think around early last year, I flew back to China. But it was just a week shooting, and I came back. And since there, yeah, again, it's very quiet. I'm starting to focus right now here in Hollywood. I want to learn the market. I want to see how things goes. I want to work with the studio here, with those production. And that's why I came here, to push a little bit my acting and to try new challenges.
Does being in these sort of more Chinese-focused Jackie Chan movies open doors in Hollywood as well?
That's what I thought, because people like really, they're really impressed with my showreel and my resume, but it doesn't help to get jobs. I think it's very different the way here is, it's happened from Asia or even other places, because here, I mean, it's helped me to get agency. It's helped me to get my agent, and you know, I'm training now with 8711, which is a big team. Because my work with Jackie, so I got 8711. It's a very good team. You know, it's the best team here, and you get invite. You can only be invited. So I got introduction to them because people saw my work. So yes, it's helped me a bit to get along, but not regard work. Mm-hmm. Because I respect here. There's a lot of, I guess, you know, you have to earn it. You have to be part of teams, and you have to socialize if it's regard a stunt work. But with acting, I don't even know how it's work. You know, you have to go casting, you have to meet, and I'm new here, and new face, so I will have to learn the way.
Is there a political angle at all to that? Having such a prolific Chinese CV, does that factor in, or have you felt that at all ever in Hollywood?
I don't think they care much. I don't think here they care what you did back anywhere else, unless it's a Hollywood production. And I did Hollywood production. I was on The Mechanic too with mm-hmm. Jason Statham, but I just action performed there. I had a small part being Tommy Lee Jones' bodyguard. I was on Outcast, you know, a stuntman, but all of them were cast in China. So they don't recognize it until you don't make project here. I don't think they will recognize it. That's what I think. Unless it's very individual and specific, and somebody would be like, oh, I like Tomer, I like what he did, he's good, let's work with him.
Well, now that you're with 8711, I guess we'll see you in the next John Wick movie.
I'm not part of the 8711. I'm not a core team. I'm just
oh, gotcha. You're working with them.
Yeah, I'm just invited to train in their facility.
Gotcha.
So I'm training with them. Well, now it's closed, but usually I train one twice a week. Under Chad Jaslewski, mm-hmm. Very good class, amazing class. I learned a lot because it's totally different style. It's like you say, John Wick style, all judo choreography. So I'm learning a lot. It's definitely different, so different.
Thank you to Harris Stang, Nathan Wang, and Tomer Oz for being on the show. I think that's it for this episode.
Our original music comes from Elliot Saltmarsh and Yehuda of Fist with a PH, and our art comes courtesy of Jay Castro.
Follow us on Twitter at China Film Pod, like the Upper in the Studio Facebook page, and if you can afford it, we would really appreciate a contribution to our Patreon at patreon.com/upperinthestudio. We're looking to hire Farah Khan for our show's overly elaborate dance number. Help out. And if you feel like it, have some thoughts or suggestions, email us at upperinthestudio@gmail.com.
Next week, we'll be talking about The Foreigner, but before we leave you this week, we just want to share some wisdom from the chairman.
To read too many books is harmful. We will see you in a week.